This is Gardner vs. District Court or Henderson Water Park LLC 70823. Mr. Williams and Mr. McLeod. Mr. Williams, if you're ready to proceed.
Thank you, Justice Douglas. May it please the court, my name is Colby Williams. I'll be presenting the argument on behalf of the petitioners this afternoon. Good afternoon, Justice Douglas, Justice Pickering, Justice Gibbons. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. In our writ petition, we argue that there were two important issues of law that impacted the public policy of this state. The first issue was whether individual members and managers of a limited liability company could be held personally liable for their own tortious conduct, despite the fact that Nevada has two statutes, NRS 86.371 and 86.381, which provide members and managers with certain protections. The second question we asked the court to determine was whether alter ego liability applied to limited liability corporations. I would respectfully submit that this court has already answered the first question in the affirmative in the coordinated appeal in this action. I'll refer to that opinion as Gardner 1. In Gardner 1, the court made clear that, quote, NRS 86.371 and 86.381 do not shield members from liability for personal negligence, end quote. In so doing, this court cited its opinion in Semenza v. Coughlin Holmes, a case we had cited below, in which the court observed more than 20 years ago, in the analogous context of corporations, and I again quote, an officer of a corporation may be individually liable for any tort which he commits. This has been a well-settled principle of corporate law for many years. In fact, one of the cases we cited, the Morgan case from New Hampshire, has characterized this as black letter, horn book law. In recent years, many courts have applied this principle to members and managers of LLCs, and now this court, we respectfully submit, has done the same. So, how does the opinion in Gardner 1 affect this writ petition? To briefly review, the district court denied our motion for leave to amend our complaint to add seven individual defendants who are members of a management committee of Henderson Water Park, LLC.
And just to be clear, the motion was filed well within the time allotted under the scheduling order, so we're dealing with a pure futility type analysis by the district court.
That's absolutely right, Justice Pickering. It was timely. It was relatively early in the discovery process. There was no argument that it was untimely. It was pure futility. And the getting to that point, the district court denied our proposed amendment on grounds of futility because the judge believed that NRS 86.371 precluded members and managers of LLCs from being sued personally at all.
Well, now, assuming we agree with you on that and your analysis on it, what is, and we know you filed the amended complaint, you've done discovery, you've taken depositions and all that in this case, what evidence have you developed that these managers who are different than members, you know, we got different classifications in these LLCs, have individually committed any torts? I mean, are they involved in running the water park? I know there was an issue of how many lifeguards there were, and also maybe you could tie that together because I think, we'll hear from opposing it, but I think your point is anybody can commit an individual tort no matter who they are. You know, so the question is what did they do in this case?
Sure, and of course we are at the pleading stage, Your Honor. It's an amended complaint, so
right.
We don't have to prove our case.
I understand. I just want to know what the allegation is.
But I'm happy to address that.
Okay.
And while we've alleged
and
a number.
And doing that, I was trying to think of if this were a corporate entity instead of an LLC.
Right.
And you had corporate directors or corporate managers as CEO who evaluated from Clark County that you were supposed to have 17 lifeguards but ended up with 3 to 5 or 7 in this part of the park. Would you think the analysis is exactly the same as to the individual tort liability under your proposed amended complaint? And so, therefore, the entity is irrelevant for purposes of your negligence claim. Alter ego is a separate issue, and we can talk about
correct.
That. But would you be, do you believe you could sue a corporate officer or a corporate CEO or a corporate manager individually on the allegations you've stated here against the managers of this LLC?
Respectfully, the answer to that question is yes. And the evidence that we've developed thus far, and I will talk about sort of the legal underpinnings of my position, but with respect to the evidence that had been developed thus far, Justice Gibbons, we had alleged and quoted in the proposed amended complaint from the operating agreement. The operating agreement vests this management committee, comprised of seven members, with sole and exclusive responsibility for the business affairs and operating the water park. Okay, so this isn't a situation like the Cortez case from Oregon that you cited in Gardner 1, where there was a delegation of managerial responsibility. These people delegated themselves. And the touchstone, when you look at the basis for imposing liability on individual officers of a corporation or directors or individual members and managers of LLCs, is this: personal participation. Okay. We are not here arguing that a passive investor in an LLC could be held liable for the negligence that we've alleged here if he or she or it did not participate in the alleged wrongful conduct. And participation can take a variety of forms. You can actually commit the alleged act. You can direct it. You can authorize it. You can ratify it. Personal participation is the key in both the corporate context and in the LLC context. And I can take it a bit further by looking at the court's opinion in Semenza. Let's look at what Semenza involved. Semenza was a lawsuit against a home building company, Coughlin Homes, and its president and shareholder. His name was Mr. Means. The allegation was that both had made the decision not to install adequate drainage in the plaintiff's homes and to do so to save costs. And negligence claims were brought against both. The plaintiffs prevailed against the company. They lost against the individual president and shareholder. And the district court then awarded fees to the prevailing defendant, the individual president and shareholder. It came up to this court, and this court reversed. And it reversed by saying that the plaintiff had a reasonable basis for pursuing the lawsuit against Means because they had evidence that they believed he personally directed the decision to not put in the adequate drainage, and there was no dispute that there was, in fact, a drainage problem in the house. Look at the allegations here. What we've alleged in the proposed amended complaint, it's at pages 97 through 109 of the appendix, was that these members of the management committee personally made the decision not to use the required number of lifeguards as required by the health district permit. Now, we can debate down below at a different stage with respect to whether the health district was right or not, but the undisputed evidence is that the permit required there to be 17 lifeguards at the wave pool. The undisputed evidence is that they only had three there that day. It was a conscious decision. One of the members of the management committee has testified that they agreed to violate the law. I'm not making that up. That is the testimony. So with respect to what we've alleged, again, we're at the pleading stage, I don't think there's any doubt that under this court's guidance from Gardner 1, that we've satisfied the pleading standards that are required in our amended complaint. And we actually use the language that they directly, that they personally participated, that they directed the alleged conduct, or that they authorized it. That, to me, really seems to be the touchstone, whether we're talking about a member or a manager or an officer or a director, depending on the corporate form. It's personal participation. And if you look at your cases that you cited in Gardner 1, Cortez from Oregon, as well as Petch from Louisiana, they, too, look at that. That's the touchstone, if you will. Now, in both of those cases, they were summary judgment cases, and by the time the case got to that stage, the plaintiffs hadn't carried their burden, and so summary judgment was granted against the plaintiffs. But insofar as the underlying principle, we've satisfied that for purposes of pleading the amended complaint here. So unless the court has any more questions on that issue, I can move to alter ego.
Well, if I could just do an analogy on it, to a corporation, which you're going to get into an alter ego,
sure,
anyway. if a board of directors of a corporation did the same thing, let's say it's a big hotel corporation or something, right. They cut back on the lifeguards, you would feel those directors would have personal liability as well under Semenza.
I do, Justice Gibbons. Now, it may be that corporate directors would, as an affirmative defense, assert protection under the business judgment rule. Okay, but that certainly that hasn't been done here, and I don't think it would apply in any event, given the conduct that we've alleged here. But I absolutely do believe that. But the key is personal participation, because if you look at the Cortez case, what they say is general corporate law, and the same would apply here for, you know, LLC law, is that you're generally not liable for the acts of your subordinate. I mean, unless you directed them to do something or ratified it after the fact, or you personally participated in it, just being a director, just like being a manager or a member of an LLC, isn't enough. If you're a passive investor, or if you delegated, and it's not a negligent delegation of duty, then you aren't liable in that scenario. But we submit that's not what the case is here.
Okay. On the alter ego, I'll just have one. I know there's time. I'll tell you what my concern is.
Sure.
If you can address it is. In corporate law, there are statutes that allow for alter ego suits and all. There isn't in Chapter 86. So
right.
Can we allow an alter ego suit that isn't authorized by statute under some other basis? Or what's your thoughts on that?
I believe you can, Your Honor, because, Justice Gibbons, the concept of alter ego liability in the corporate context has existed for a long time. But it was only in 2001 that it was codified as an actual statutory exception. But there certainly was the ability to bring that claim before there was a statutory exception. Now, the legislature made it clear that you can pursue that type of liability in the context of corporations, but if you read Judge Markell's opinion from the U.S. Bankruptcy Court, it's GM Petra, he goes through the analysis because the amendment to the corporate statutes occurred in 2001, but what it basically was some horse trading. They wanted to increase corporate franchise fees in order to get that on. There was an attachment to the bill that, okay, well, we're going to now codify alter ego liability for corporations. But the fact that that hasn't happened yet in LLCs, or the fact that it may never happen, to me, does not mean that you can't pursue that theory of relief. Okay? The district court or the bankruptcy court went through that analysis because otherwise you would create anomalous results, right?
Well, you'd also be licensing. I mean, the guts of alter ego is fraud, that I'm going to do business in a limited liability form but way undercapitalize myself. And, I mean, that's a quintessential common law.
Exactly, Your Honor. That's the point. Yeah. You would be sanctioning a corporate vehicle by which everyone would flock to, right? Because you would be basically eliminating a potential source of liability if alter ego didn't apply to LLCs.
Was there anything in the amendments in 2001 that amended Chapter 86 in the course of that?
To be frank, I can't answer whether there were any amendments. There certainly weren't any amendments that addressed alter ego liability in the context of 86.
And LLCs didn't come along, was it after that date? I can't remember.
1991. So if you look at the legislative history in 1991, which we've provided to the district court and we quote in our brief, I think it's at pages 25 and 26 of the petition, we quote the legislative history because this question comes up. You know, is alter ego liability going to apply to LLCs? And there's a debate about that. And the consensus, there's three legislators, one of which was former Judge Porter, talking about it, and they say, yeah, the goal is to have the whatever protections apply to corporations and LLCs need to be the same. So if alter ego liability is a source of potential liability in the corporate context, it needs to be in the LLC context. And it was subsequently in 2001 that it was added as a statutory exception to the corporate statutes, but not here. So
okay.
I'll reserve my minute 35. Thank you very much.
We're going to wind up giving you full 3 minutes. We'll add another minute and a half to counsel's argument.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Justices Pickering, Douglas, and Gibbons. I'm Alexandra McLeod from Thorndale, Armstrong, Delk, Balkin, Bush, and Isinger, and with me at council table is Mr. Paul Isinger. We represent the respondents here today. Maybe the only thing that the respondents and the petitioners agree on today is that Gardner 1 is instructive. However, we believe that it instructs on different things. The petitioner's May 5th, 2016 motion for leave to amend sought to add 7 individual defendants who are members of Henderson Water Park LLC's management committee but hold no direct ownership in Henderson Water Park. We believe all 7 of these individuals are entitled to statutory immunity under NRS 86.371 and .381. Contrary to what has been alleged by plaintiffs, 6 of the 7 individuals are non-employee passive investors in the company. The trial court concluded that the requested amendment and inclusion of the individuals who make up the defendant's management committee would be futile, as such individuals are improper defendants.
What if one of these people has dual capacity, maybe has some management authority directly over the water park, and goes down there and says, look, cut your lifeguards in half, even though it's the city or county law requires more. Isn't that committing an individual tort then like that? And isn't that a different status?
The question is, if that happened as alleged, is that individual making an operations decision which exposes the company to vicarious liability, or is that person making a management committee decision? And the very nature of a committee means that decisions cannot be made unilaterally by one individual.
Well, but so you would then, like, let's say the guy gets in the car, a company car, and drives drunk, but he's going somewhere for the company. Now, in that instance, he could be personally held liable.
I think that is where Gardner 1 is instructive in this case, because the facts as proposed by Your Honor are highly distinguishable. In the case of a driver, the driver has an independent personal duty as the holder of a driver's license to obey the rules of the road, one of which, of course, is not to drive under the influence. And by driving under the influence in a company capacity, he then exposes the company to vicarious liability.
So I see that. Let's change the facts slightly. He goes to the swimming pool and he wants to befriend all the lifeguards and have them love him. So he says, why don't you all go home today? It'll be fine. Is he personally liable for that act?
Again, we believe that that is an operations decision which potentially, if it happened as alleged, could expose the company to vicarious liability.
But could he be held in on a complaint alleging personal liability? I mean, if he drives drunk, I think he can be. I think we would concede that, right?
I see Your Honor's point, but what's particular here is the way that the allegations were alleged in the complaint. Specifically, paragraph 48.
Hang on me just for a moment. On your theory of liability, if one of these defendants, I don't know the pronunciation, but the guy who gave the depot testimony, let's say he went to the park and said, I want everyone to love me today and I'm letting all the employees go home. I'll just hang around here and take money at the gate. And he let all the lifeguards go even though there was a bunch of little kids. And he knew it was a violation of state law to have an unattended, unlifeguarded pool. Could he be held personally liable in your theory of LLC liability?
We don't believe so, because at the heart of the matter is that lifeguard staffing is a company duty, not an individual one. This court, when it decided Gardner 1...
Okay, I see what you're saying.
...looked specifically at the allegations in the complaint. And the allegations referenced in the original complaint at paragraph 25, those are identical. The very same allegations as appear in paragraph 48 of plaintiff's proposed amended complaint. That's the appendix at pages 107 and 108. Paragraph 48 is identical. The duties alleged are identical to the duties alleged in paragraph 40, which is directed to the company.
Well,
and identical significant.
They augment that with the duties. They augment that with pages 7 through 8 of the complaint that individually, the guy knew that you're supposed to have 17 lifeguards, and he directed to have fewer than 17. And so he personally knows that. You're saying because he's doing that under the auspices of corporate business, that that insulates him from individual tort liability?
Plaintiff's allegations cannot create individual duty when it is a company duty at issue. And Gardner 1, this court, this very panel, actually looked at those very same allegations and found that they lack specificity as how any individual act by the member LLCs, or in this context, applied to the LLC managers, contributed to the minor plaintiff's injuries.
Well, isn't there a difference between members and managers? I mean, if an LLC is like a limited partnership, I mean, you have the general partner limited. The general partner is liable for the acts of the limited partnership. So I think managers versus members is different, you know. And that's one issue. The second one is this a genuine issue of material fact? In other words, should the judge have allowed the amendment and then tested it through a motion for summary judgment?
To your first question, whether members or managers are the same, under NRS 86.371, it uses the words members or managers interchangeably. So we would believe that the statutory protections that would apply to the member LLCs should also apply to the LLC managers by operation of the language of that statute. The protections should be applied equally to members or managers. The difference, of course, here is that the members of Henderson Water Park LLC are also LLCs, which are companies, right, which have to act through individuals, where the management committee is made up of individuals instead of companies.
Well, I guess in our minds, Ms. McLeod, you know, we have to come up with these decisions. We're trying to do the right thing and analyze it, but we're analogizing this to corporate structure. Members are like shareholders. Managers are like directors or officers, depending on what they do here. So we're trying to layer this to make some common sense decisions, because I'm concerned that, you know, people can hide behind LLCs where they can't hide behind corporations based on the way you want us to interpret the statutes.
And the real concern, following up on Justice Gibbons' position, is looking at Gardner 1, it kind of opened the door to say, we'll let you allege it to see if you can prove it. If you can't prove it, we're going to shut you down. That's kind of a notice pleading situation. That's kind of the bumper, the bottom level that we're at. Is that notice pleading sufficient? And it gives an opportunity, but it also the opportunity to shut it down. So that's the question, especially in this where it's, our black letter law is not totally defined. We have these gray areas as we're playing with LLCs.
Leapfrogging your question, Justice Gibson, to answer yours, and I will make my darndest effort to come back. The idea here that we have the procedural history is almost backwards, as the order that the trial court considered things as opposed to when they came up before this honorable court. In fact, the motion to amend was decided before the summary judgment. And in deciding the summary judgment about the member LLCs, Judge Weiss looked back at the argument about the issue we're here on today and said his reasoning was the same. And for those reasons, we believe that when this court affirmed Judge Weiss's decision to grant summary judgment in favor of the two member LLCs, that they spoke on this question.
But looking at this, I mean, we always start with this premise, motions to amend, timely made, freely given. Then we kind of move somewhere dicey into futility. So
freely given if justice so requires, not merely if justice allows or leave of court would not be necessary. The futility standard is significant here because it means that the trial court has necessarily determined as a matter of law that granting the motion for leave to amend will not make any difference for the reason that Judge Weiss would simply have granted a subsequent motion to dismiss or motion for summary judgment on the grounds of statutory immunity anyway. Furthermore, in the writ context, as opposed to the appeal context that Gardner 1 was decided, the standard is higher. It's an extraordinary high standard for an extraordinary writ. Writ should only issue if the trial court's ruling was a manifest abuse or arbitrary or capricious exercise of discretion. Judge Weiss here read the briefs, asked questions, listened to argument, took the matter under advisement, did independent research beyond what was cited by the parties in the briefing, and in that context, his decision can hardly be said to be improvident, thoughtless, or without due consideration. So the idea that leave should be freely given, when really reviewed and the procedural history of this case and the standard that the writ comes before the court, I think is an easy argument to make, but one that shouldn't ultimately carry the day under the high standard
of the
court.
The law is statutory interpretation, and that's de novo review from us. It's a legal issue, and with all deference to our great colleagues in district court, the buck stops with us. So if the statutes say what we say, they say. So we're trying to, you know, get through this, and we look to the plain meaning and everything else, and I understand your arguments, but we have to weigh all that in coming up with the decision.
Certainly, and getting back to Your Honor's prior questions about the members and managers and the statutory construction for business entities in Nevada, obviously it is a legislative function to determine what the qualifications for each entity will be and what the protections for each entity will be. We strongly believe that extending the alter ego doctrine to LLCs when it is not present in Chapter 86 is not a judicial function, but a legislative one. The legislative history...
And you base that on the fact that specific provision was made in 78 for alter ego liability?
Correct.
And anything else?
And correct. And in this court, in the Webb v. Shule case, took a pause and said, because the parties assumed
but
that...
But it hadn't been adequately developed in Webb v. Shule, right?
Correct. The parties assumed that it applied, and the court said, if you're going to assume it applies, we will too. Here we go. But that might have been a tacit recognition by that court that it is a legislative function and not a judicial one to extend the arm of the statutes.
That may be reading Webb v. Shule for more than it's worth, but I'm not convinced, and it's a problem for me, that you can create an LLC and deliberately undercapitalize it and have it engage in liability-producing activities and not have the possibility of piercing that entity's shield. I think it would be extraordinary policy to say that's the case. The piercing the corporate veil and alter ego liability originates as a common law doctrine to prevent abuse of limited liability entities doing business in that form in a way that's unfair and unintended, right?
Your Honor is completely correct that it originated as a common law
doctrine. If the legislature meant to create this mighty LLC that can undercapitalize itself and yet enjoy this completely impenetrable liability, that would be an extraordinary act, don't you think? I think you're reading more into the provision in Chapter 78 of codifying alter ego in that context. I'm having trouble saying it negatively implies that there's no common law alter ego remaining for LLCs, which are really not known in common law, but the idea that if you have a fraud where the entity is working a fraud on innocent people and you've deliberately undercapitalized and unfairly exploited this form of doing business, we're going to let it go through. Could you let her answer?
I was going to say.
I'm sorry. I'm asking a very long question, but it's of concern to me.
Would that be extraordinary? I think in the context where LLCs were created before alter ego was codified, that the absence of alter ego from Chapter 86 has to be assumed to be an intentional by our legislature. We have confidence in them that they knew that the LLCs had already been on the books for 10 years when they chose to codify it and did so as to corporations only.
Did they do anything else as to LLCs when they, in the course of codifying the alter ego liability?
Not that I saw in the legislative history, Your Honor. Furthermore, the petitioners say that they're seeking to pierce the limited liability veil for failure to follow the formalities of the business. But failing to follow corporate formalities is not meaningful in the LLC context, and maybe that's one of the reasons that it was not included in Chapter 86 by the legislature. The informality of the organization is what's borrowed from the partnership context, and then the limited liability is borrowed from the corporation context, so that a separate and distinct manner or procedure for piercing a limited liability veil should be outlined by our legislature.
Okay, fair enough. Thank you.
May I stop you right there? Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Williams, if you comment on that, because that's our tough dilemma here. It wasn't incorporated in Chapter 86 when it was under corporate law. So are we legislating by accepting the alter ego doctrine or not? How do we deal with that as a court?
No, I don't think you are. First of all, the hypothetical argument presented here with respect to the corporate formalities, that hasn't been presented below, and I don't think it makes a difference here. The rule of statutory construction that is being relied upon by the district court, which in turn was premised on the Nevada lawyer article, was one that a negative inference is created where certain language is used in one statute and then it is omitted from another. But there's a very important point that we've made that's never been addressed.
It's part of the same act.
It's got to be part of the same act. It has to be part of the same act. Of course, corporations are Chapter 78. LLCs are Chapter 86. Otherwise, if you took that argument to its logical extension, if we left out, you know, certain language that addressed corporations and we left it out of the workers' comp statutes, that would be meaningful. I mean, you can't extend it that broadly.
Can you sue a limited partnership for alter ego? I don't think you can you? A limited partnership, that concept's not recognized that I'm aware of.
Your Honor, to be frank, I hesitate to respond because I haven't looked at that, so I don't want to give you a wrong answer.
You're right. I'll withdraw the question.
Make myself
I'm
look,
using up here, and I shouldn't. We'll stick to the legal issues.
But I certainly appreciate the point.
Very pointedly, counsel has indicated that Gardner 1 kind of shuts you down. Mm-hmm. What's your...
I just couldn't disagree more, Justice Douglas. I mean, I think you hit the nail on the head. Justice Gardner 1 gave us guidance with respect to answering the first question that we presented, which is the legal question of can you pursue members and managers of an LLC on an individual basis if the allegation is that they personally engaged in a tort? I submit that you answered that question yes. Now, it doesn't mean we've proved it. I mean, we're not there yet. We were seeking leave to amend to file a complaint. And while we had done some discovery certainly was not done, and it still isn't done. So I understand the desire.
I would say, though, to her argument that your proposed amended complaint is substantially the same as the original complaint. We've now affirmed summary judgment on those allegations being insufficient to state an individual liability claim. I think that's what she's saying.
I think you're right.
You've got a preclusion issue going on there.
Right.
Could you comment on that?
I think you're correct that that's what she's saying, but I don't adopt the correctness of that argument. The setting was different in Gardner 1. First of all, we were talking about not individuals. We were talking about other LLC entities. That was decided on the basis of our original complaint because of the order that things were presented to the district court below. When we went to seek leave to amend, and that was denied, they then used that as a platform to come in on summary judgment. And so that was all in the context of our original complaint.
But they're trying to say that just because an entity does something that is negligent and people who work for that entity know that the entity did that, that doesn't mean there's personal liability. I think that's right. What they're trying to get at.
They may be getting, maybe with knowledge we could quibble, but our complaint isn't based on knowledge. Our complaint is based, proposed amended complaint is based on personal participation. And I heard a lot of argument about what's an operational duty versus what's a personal duty. And let me just address that if I could, because I think that sort of is the point here. If we go back to Semenza.
Go ahead and finish your thought.
Thank you, Your Honor. If you go back to Semenza, the quote that was used in Gardner 1 was a partial quote. Okay, the full quote was as follows. An officer of a corporation may be individually liable for any tort which he commits. It stops there in Gardner. And if the tort is committed within the scope of employment, the corporation may be vicariously or secondarily liable under the doctrine of respondeat superior. So the notion that I can engage in certain operational duties that wouldn't subject me to personal liability, I think is a fiction. Even the Cortez case that was cited in Gardner 1 makes that point. If you look at the types of duties that they were talking about that proof wasn't established for a summary judgment, but it was negligently forming a general safety plan, negligently delegating responsibility for implementing the safety procedures, negligently exercising oversight authority. That's operations. That's what this management committee has responsibility over. They delegated to themselves. They absolutely can be held liable in this context if we develop the evidence and present the proof at trial. We just ask this court to let us get there. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for the arguments from both sides. Based on our questions and what you gave us today, this is a very interesting area of law right now. We appreciate the arguments. You've given us something to chew on, to be blunt. With that, this matter will stand submitted.